The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for April 1st, 2017, and I'm not fooling. I received great feedback on my conversation with Carol Montgomery from last week. So it seems that everyone who stopped by her warm showers way station in Texas has come away with the same feelings of gratitude and joy after meeting the 87-year-old and staying at the bunkhouse. It might just be worth going out of your way, if you're going through Texas, to stop somewhere near Carmine just to say hello to Carol and sample her cuisine, which is supposed to be excellent. I'm also pleased to report that I've accepted a position on the advisory board to the East Coast Greenway Alliance. It's an honor and a privilege, and I hope that I'm able to contribute some value to the ECG group. If you are interested, you can find out more about the Greenway at greenway.org. And with 3,000 miles between Maine and Florida, there must be some part of it you'd like to ride and explore. So I haven't talked about a great video in a long while, but in honor of the April 1st date, and again, no joke, my favorite video of the week is When Ice Skating Meets Hiking. It was posted to Facebook by BuzzFeed Sweaty. It's 60 seconds of crazy skating along what looks like an iced-over bike path in Duluth, Minnesota. Perhaps my favorite parts are the dogs running alongside the skaters and the guy sliding down the trail on his butt. I have to admit, it looked like a lot of fun. All right, there is more fun to come. Let's move on with our show. My first guest is a winner, a double first place NABS 2017 winner, to be exact. Dave Kirk took home his first-place ribbons for Best Road Bike and Best Fillet-Braised Bike at the Handmade Show this year, and since it's been 6 years since I last spoke with him on the show, I figured we were long overdue. Dave started working in a bike shop when he was 17, spent 10 years with Cerata in New York, worked with Carl Strong for a while, and opened Kirk Frameworks in 2003. In a word, his frames are immaculate. He and his wife live in Bozeman, Montana, where she's a ski instructor, and he builds his frames by himself, one at a time. We chat about a great many things, and I was especially interested in his JK specials, and I think you might be too. After our break, I'm going to talk with a reporter by the name of Tom Cuglin. He is the natural resources reporter for the Independent Record out of Helena, Montana. This week, an amendment was slapped onto Senate Bill 363 that would require a $25 fee on out-of-state bicycles. There's more to it than that, but I'm going to let Tom give us the lowdown. After a little break for the usual station ID and a bit of music, we'll jet east to Boston to speak with Mass Bikes Director Richard Fries. To say there's a lot of stuff going on in cycling in Boston is a gross understatement. And since he accepted the director's position, Richard has had some amazing successes with a lot more to come. We used to look at New York City for bike inspiration. Now I think we can look to the entire state of Massachusetts. So it's off to Bozeman, Montana we go to speak with Dave Kirk. Hello, Dave. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's been way too long since the last time we had a little conversation.
It has been. In our pre-chat email, you said it was 6 years, and that is just hard to believe.
I know, which would have made you one of my first frame-building interviews because we celebrated our sixth year on the show last September.
Well, congratulations. And we were just children then.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. And now we are still not adults, right?
No. Older, but not necessarily adults.
Or wiser. Oh, maybe we're a little wiser. I do want to congratulate you on taking home two best of awards at NABS, best brazed bike, best road bike. I mean, or fillet brazed bike and best road bike. How cool is that?
Thank you. Yeah, I was surprised. Frankly, I wasn't hugely surprised that the fillet bike did well. I expected it might. It was a little unusual in its execution, and I think it was well done. So I thought definitely it was a contender. But my road bike winning surprised me because I figured the industry and the desires of the public had moved on somewhat from what I typically offer. I figured the best road bike would have disc brakes and through axles and a big bottom bracket and a big head tube and all that stuff. And that's not necessarily what I typically offer. In the bike that I won best road bike with has traditional quick release axles. It has rim brakes. It has all of that. So I put it in hoping to win the lottery, and I guess I did.
I guess you did. Well, grasshopper, so much for thinking you don't know what's going on, right? Or you know what's going on.
I guess so.
So I went back to your website before our conversation. I want to delve a little bit into your philosophy of making things and working one-on-one with clients, which sort of dovetails with what my career has been in the bike business, you know, basically custom bikes working one-on-one. I want to start with making things, though. Since you began building frames, what have you noticed about the culture around people who actually make things? I mean, we can go back to Bruce Gordon and his Swamp Toast,
sure,
which we can't really say on air. We could say stuff, I guess, but we can't use the other S word. So tell me what you think about this maker movement.
Well, you know, I got into the culture of making things as a child a very long time ago because in our household, if you wanted something, you typically made it. I don't come from a well-to-do family, and if you wanted something, typically you probably couldn't afford it, so you made it instead. And it wasn't looked down upon. It wasn't, what's the word I'm looking for? It wasn't revered at the time, but it was just practical. If you wanted something, you made it. And my father, John, kind of instilled that in me. And unfortunately, John passed away when I was still very young. But my mother remarried a wonderful man named Jim, who was very much of the same bent. He just made everything. I remember one of the first televisions we had when I was a kid was a television he made from a kit. And it's like, who makes a television, right?
So, right.
That culture was instilled in me. And then all of that kind of building things movement went away, and we got to the point where everything was disposable, and everything came out of a mold, or you flipped a lever on a machine and the thing dropped into the box and was shipped out. And I think the pendulum is swinging back toward people making things and having an attraction toward goods that where they can see the hand of the maker. And I think that is affecting the bicycle business in a good way, in that we have more and more people that are interested in buying something from a craftsman, from someone who understands their needs and builds something to meet them.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about perfection, but that just brought up something else for me. Who is your typical client? Who comes to you for a bicycle?
That's a good, you know, I suppose I have a typical client. It's hard to pin down. The typical age of a client, although I don't ask the age of people typically, I'm guessing it's in the 40 to 60 range is the typical age of my client. They're unfortunately mostly male. I do get a few female customers, but not as many as I would like. And it is never their first bicycle. they usually have a garage full of bikes by the time they come to me. And typically what they're looking for, interestingly enough, is something that has a little more life to it, a little more soul to the whole thing. They've tried mass-produced bikes, they've tried carbon bikes, they've had all the gee-whiz wonder bikes, and they've left them feeling a little empty, and they wonder what it's like to have a well-crafted, lightweight steel bike. I can't tell you how many times I've put a bike like this under one of these guys and then had them email me 6 months later and said, I sold all my other bikes and I just didn't use them anymore.
Isn't that interesting? Yes. Whenever we deliver like a Waterford or another steel bike, and people have had, a Specialized or some other carbon bike or an aluminum bike or even a titanium bike sometimes, what they often remember is their experience of their very first Raleigh 3-speed, that feeling under you of that steel touching the road, which is so different.
It is different, and it's impossible. It's like describing a color. How do you describe a color to someone? But when you feel it, it's a very good thing. And for many people, it resonates. For some, it doesn't. And for the folks that are counting grams and just want the lightest possible thing that their dollar can buy, they're not going to pick a steel bike. But for people that are looking for a more holistic experience and they're looking for a special feel on the road, steel can be very difficult to beat.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I want to talk a little bit about the work itself, because you won this Fillet Braised, you won the best road bike. But I want to know about perfection. So you have that engineering kind of mind. You have that artistic mind. I'm married to a guy just like that, artistic with the engineering. And you wonder when enough is enough. And it's a difficult place to make that decision of when you stop filing, when you stop, shaping. When is it that you get to it and you finally go, oh, that's it? Or is this enough? Do you run into that as a dilemma?
I used to quite a bit. And I am compulsive by nature, and I want everything to be as close to perfect as I can get it. And at the same time, I have to be pragmatic. I have to put bikes in boxes and get them out the door. So going way back to my days at Cirrata, I started working at Cirrata in New York State back in 1989. And I would my first job there was just sanding and filing things, and I stood at my bench for 8 hours a day and sanded things till my hands were raw. Then I came in the next day and did it again. And the very experienced guys that I was working under at the time would come over and give you a dope slap and say, that's enough of that. And you'd say, but it's not perfect yet. And it's like, well, no, it's perfect enough. And that's not to degrade it at all, but you can, if you're building a bike and you want to get a nice smooth finish on it and it's going to be painted, there is zero sense of going in there with 1,000 grit sandpaper and then putting, to make it a mirror-like finish and then putting paint on top of it.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense. You are just throwing away your time and you're not spending your customer's money well. You would be better off moving on to the next bike or spending that time working on something that matters. I remember an incident or a time at Cirrata when a bike came across my workbench, and I was very new there. I'd been there for a few months, and I really wanted to make sure everything was perfect. And this bike came across my bench that was going to go to Bicycling Magazine for a test. And so I thought, well, I'm going to make this bike perfect. And I sanded every square inch of that thing, Like, I was sanding the middle of tubes. The tubes are perfectly fine. The tubes are perfectly smooth. Why am I sanding them? Because I felt like I needed to do something, and I just didn't know better. And somebody came over and gave me that same dope slap and said, all right, you can stop doing that now. You're not making anything better. And through that process, I learned what matters and what doesn't, and what is close enough. It can be a very slippery slope. One can justify doing substandard work by saying, well, nothing's perfect. I don't want to pretend, or I don't want to give the idea that we're going there. But there is a point where there you go past there's diminishing returns, and it really doesn't make any sense.
Right. Okay. That's what I was trying to get to. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dave Kirk. He is the winner of two NABS awards this year, the best Philip Braze bike and the best road bike. We are going to talk about the Philip Braze bike in a second, but I want to ask you something that is a little more esoteric, and that is, what happens when you start to build a frame? So now you've got your client, he or she has picked the frame, you've got your fitting, the tubes are there. Does something like this alchemy happen that makes that frame take on its own life? Does that make sense to you? Do you know what I'm saying?
It does, and it's sort of, I'm not sure if this is the right word, there's sort of a metaphysical bent to it. You know, like, do the feelings of the customer and the builder meld together to go into the metal?
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
And frankly, I don't know. It's above my pay grade. I really don't know. I am a very pragmatic person. And what I try to do is I try to get the customer to share any and all of their feelings about this bike in particular, about cycling, about how they ride their bike, where they ride their bike, that whole thing. And I get them to share that, and I do my absolute best to understand it, and we go back and forth until I feel I have a firm understanding of what they're going to do with the bike. Then I go through and I design the bike, and I share that design with them to make sure that we're on the same page and that there's no miscommunication. And then once we're on the same page, I build it. So it could, one, say that those two mental images and feelings or anything melded together to go into the steel? I suppose so. It's not something I feel. I don't feel moved from somewhere. I feel like I need to do my best work each and every time and put the best bike I can under the customer and have it suit them in the best way possible.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Have you ever fired a customer?
Yeah.
People need to understand what that means. Go ahead. I think it speaks for itself.
It's very difficult to do. I've only done it a few times, and it's extremely rare, but it happens, that I think any custom builder you talk to will probably tell you a similar story. But occasionally you get someone who you understand is going to be unsatisfiable. Nothing you can do for them is going to make them happy. My number one aim is to make the customer happy. If I feel like, in the end, no matter how much time I spend to understand their needs and to build the bike best possible, that they're still not going to be satisfied, then there's no point in it. So I have had people come to me and say, I've dealt with all the best builders out there. I've dealt with Kirk Goodrich. I've dealt with Peter Weigel. I've dealt with everyone, and none of them can make me happy. So I'm coming to you, and I'm thinking, well, if Goodrich and Weigel aren't making you happy, these guys are really good. You know, why aren't you happy? Maybe it's not the builder.
Right. And, exactly.
So in that case, I will throw my hands up and say, well, I'm probably not good enough for you.
Ooh, good answer.
I'm sure there's probably someone out there right now listening that had one of the few people that I've, quote unquote, fired over the years is listening and saying, hey, that's what you said to me. But I said, I'm not good enough for you. I don't feel that I can satisfy you. You're going to have to continue on your quest. And I send them happily on their way to find someone that can satisfy them.
Right.
What I know in the end is that I will move on to a build where I'm going to make the customer happy, and they're going to enjoy the bike, and they're going to ride it, and they're going to say good things about the brand and about me, and they're going to ride more. And it's all an upside. When you're working for someone who really can't be happy, there's no upside.
That is very, very true. So I want to talk a little bit about this Reynolds 953 steel tubing. It is stainless tubing. Is it more difficult to work in?
It certainly is, yeah. It's mostly due to its hardness. It is an incredibly hard material, and filing it and cutting it and all of that is just tedious. It's just slow. It's not hard to do. It just takes more time. And there are certain things you need to understand about the material and working with it so to keep yourself from getting into trouble. If you take a piece of Reynolds 953 and clamp it in the vise and then just take a hacksaw to it, as often as not, half the teeth come off the hacksaw blade because it's nearly the same hardness as the hacksaw. So there are ways to get around this and to make sure that you're not getting yourself in trouble, but it is more time-consuming and harder on tooling, that's for sure.
Was that bike built for someone in particular?
Oh, you're speaking of the show bike?
The show bikes.
Yeah, for me.
Ah, you're pretty particular.
It's my own personal bike. I hadn't built myself a new bike in a very long time, and I was looking at the bike that I had been riding, and while I still very much enjoyed it, it didn't have a number of the features of my current offerings, and it just seemed silly to be riding around on something that doesn't represent my most current work, so I went ahead and built myself something new.
Well, I did see that you do offer a lot of things that I find pretty important for frames that a lot of people would say, well, why would you want to do that, like fender bosses or rack bosses or an extra set of water bottle bosses. Are you selling a lot of frames that people are requesting that for fenders for randonneuring or just touring or off-road?
I think the number one thing option I get is people asking for a bike to be built around a wider tire and room for fenders.
And what do you use for brakes?
Typically, I use a mid-reach caliper.
Yeah.
And I think they work very well. There's almost no downside to them, and you can fit a reasonably fat tire and a fender underneath it, or if you take the fender off, you can fit a pretty darn good-sized tire in there. And so what I see happening is a lot of people that just want to ride the bike year-round, maybe they live in snow country or rain country, you know, I suppose it's most of the country in the winter, and so during the winter or spring, they put some fenders on it, and they can go out and ride in more comfort. And then come high summer, they're going to go out and ride a mix of pavement and dirt and such, they take off the fender because the chance of getting wet is much lower for them. And then they put on a wider tire, and they have a great time. And there's just really almost zero compromise to it.
Well, it sounds like a really nice bike to me. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your JK special frame sets. They have a sort of a sentimental bent to them. That's where they come from. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, I'll try to make this short. It can be long.
It's okay.
My father passed away when I was a boy. His name was John Kirk, and John was a race car mechanic. And post-World War II, race car stuff, particularly in Europe, but even in the U.S., race car parts were very difficult to come by. So what race mechanics did is they took an Allard chassis and they put a Cadillac engine in it and a Buick transmission, and they put all these things together because it's what they could get their hands on. And they crafted these things into what was generically known as a special. And so my father, John Kirk, had a series of cars that he built for clients, built and maintained and tuned for them, that he called JK Specials. And when I started building a truly high-performance steel race bike, and I really wanted to have certain tubes be used, and some of them came from other manufacturers, some of them needed to be made for me to get the ride that I wanted, and so it reminded me of what my father did and just grabbing the best of what he could get and putting that together into a truly capable machine. And so when it all came together, I thought, well, there's only one thing to name this, and that's the JK Special.
That's a great story. Do you sell a few of them every year?
And it didn't even take a half hour.
Yeah, it could. I mean, you know, we'd need something a little more adult beverage-like to sit and talk like that, though, right?
There you go. What was your question?
It wasn't really about booze. It was really about whether you sell a few of them each year or are people waiting for them?
It is my number one seller.
How cool is that?
It probably, the JK Special, there's a number of variants of them with either a level top tube or a smoke top tube or with oversized tubing or the larger XL size tubing. They all come from the same JK Special family.
Wow, who knew that? That's really cool. So how long is your queue right now? If somebody were to say, build me a JK Special, when would they expect to get it if all things were a go?
Oh, typically somewhere around 8 months or so.
Well, that's not terrible. Well, oh man, it's been so good to catch up with you. That is really cool. How's Bozeman?
It's good. Well, it's good for me, and my wife would say it's not so good. Spring has seemingly come early here, so the roads are dry. There's no snow on the lawn or anything, which is almost unheard of for March. And for getting out and riding my bike, it's been very nice. My wife, who is a professional ski instructor, would wish there was more snow.
I would guess so. Exactly. Well, I just have a few of my favorite questions. What's your favorite food?
Oh, I love Mexican food.
Yeah. So do you cook?
Pretty much anything Mexican food is a winner for me.
Is there a good Mexican restaurant in Bozeman, or do you cook it yourself?
I typically cook it myself. Unfortunately, there is no true Mexican food, no good true Mexican food in Bozeman. There is kind of an interesting taco truck here that does a very nice job, but it's very fusion. It's sort of a Mexican-Korean kind of thing. That is, as odd as that sounds, it's very good, but it's not traditional Mexican food by any means.
Yeah, that is an odd combination, at least, you know, thinking about it mentally. Anyway.
The first time I heard about it, I thought, you've got to be kidding. And then my wife dragged me there, and it's like, oh, this is so good.
Well, and I didn't have to cook it. That would be my, you know, that would be my part of it.
Too, yeah.
What kind of music do you like, and do you listen to music in your shop?
I listen to music most all day in the shop. I occasionally listen to a little NPR news during the middle of the day, but typically I'm listening to music, and pretty wide-ranging. About the only thing I don't favor is sort of twangy country, but I'm a punk rocker at heart, and I listen to a lot of old punk rock and a lot of new age or new wave music, that kind of thing. And the kids would now wonder what the heck I'm listening to when music is coming blasting out of my garage and kids are riding by on their bikes. I'm sure they're thinking, what the heck is that?
They'll learn soon enough.
Yeah, exactly.
And do you have any pets?
Do I have pets? Yes, my wife and I have two cats. And as much as I've tried to train either of them to be shop cats, they do not like the noise. And as soon as it starts making noise, boom, they're gone.
I understand totally. Well, this has just been delightful. I once again want to congratulate you on taking home two Best of Awards at NABS. And next year, it's going to Connecticut. You going to go that far east?
You know, I'm not sure. I haven't made up my mind yet. It depends on how much it's going to cost to do it and how I can afford to go. It is exceedingly expensive for a one-man shop to do and hard to justify in the terms of sales. But if I can afford to, if it can make financial sense for me to go, I will certainly be there. And I think it will be the biggest and best NABS ever. I think the population base and the cycling community in the Northeast, where I'm originally from, is just huge. And I think it will that will reflect in a big show.
I think you're right. And because we're East, we hope to go this year. I wasn't able to go to Salt Lake. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk with me today. And congratulations again, and have a great spring and summer.
Thank you. And hopefully we get to talk again in fewer than 6 years.
Yeah. Let's just definitely say we'll do that.
I'll pencil it in.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Dave Kirk joined me from his home in Bozeman, Montana, where the winner of two coveted NABS awards is basking in that light, which I think is awesome. If you want to see his work, you can go to kirkframeworks.com. We are going to take a break. We need to let people know where we are. Actually, we're in Cleveland, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to stay right here in Montana. We'll move over from Bozeman to Helena, where we're going to speak with natural resources reporter Tom Coughlin about a bicycle amendment to what was Senate Bill 363. Let's see what Tom has to say. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for taking time to talk with me today.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Good. So you wrote an article, and I guess I hope I pronounce this correctly, the Missoulian?
Well, that's correct. I actually work in Helena, Montana for a paper called The Independent Record, but we're affiliated with the paper in Missoula and Billings, and so some of the bigger daily papers in the state of Montana.
Got it. Well, the title of the article was Bill to Fight Invasive Species Scraps Boat Decals for Fishing License Increases Bicycle Fee. Well, of course, as soon as we see bicycle fee, that throws up a flag for me. And you wrote that Senator Scott Sayles, Republican Bozeman, then introduced an amendment to put a $25 fee on out-of-state bicycles. Sayles criticized cyclists when speaking on a different bill. He called them rude and self-centered for his perception of their sharing the road. Can you give us a little bit of background on this? Do you know any of the backstory?
I do, and sort of to explain how I got into this story, I'm the outdoor writer here in Helena, so I've been following the aquatic invasive species issue. So we had our first detection, and probably folks in the Midwest can sympathize, of invasive mussels that can cause a few problems for aquatic ecosystems and that sort of stuff. So I was reporting on that story when this bill came up, which it's up against the deadline. Our legislator only meets for 90 days every 2 years. So there's a bunch of deadlines that are in the law that they have to meet, and we're basically on the last day of the deadline. So this amendment sort of came up on really what would have been a must-pass bill sort of at the last minute and pretty unexpectedly. If a little bit of the background on Senator Scales, who's our majority leader, there was a bill that came up earlier this month. It was dealing with cyclists sharing the road and vehicles. And essentially what our law says now is that a vehicle has to pass a cyclist without endangering that person riding. This bill would have sought to put some numbers to that, which would have been, 3 feet between a vehicle and a bicycle at 35 miles per hour or less, or 5 feet at faster speeds. And that's when Senator Sayles made these comments that we reported on, and were pretty widely reported in Montana, about bicyclists and his feelings about them.
You know, we have a 3-foot law that just passed here in Ohio, and we also have problems with invasive species because we're on the Great Lakes. So I do understand the two issues, and I do understand that amendments get thrown at bills at the last minute, you know, like the Hail Mary mm-hmm. kind of pass. I'm just wondering where the $25 fee idea came from, and how would – I'm trying to figure out how anybody might – collect it. A lot of people ride through Missoula, especially because of adventure cycling is there.
Sure. So to give you a little context on the Aquatic Invasive Species Bill, so this came up, and essentially what our Fish and Wildlife Department is trying to do is stand up a pretty rigorous program to protect from the spread of that issue. And that involves a lot of check stations and things like that. So they're throwing quite a bit of money at that, and there's some big asks. And they're trying to figure out what the funding mechanisms are going to be, whether that's going to be taxes on hydropower or boat decals or fishing licenses. So as they sort of worked through that and worked through those growing pains and came up against this deadline yesterday and today, this sort of came out of left field a little bit, and Senator Sayles put that on there, it was passed, and it did stay attached to the bill, so it's on the way to the House with that.
Oh, it went through the third reading already.
It did, yeah. Like I said, the deadline was today. And we can talk more about what is likely to happen to that bill down the road. It still has to go through another chamber, and it was a pretty rough bill by the sponsor's own admission. We definitely haven't seen the last of it or tweaks to it by any means. So, how they would collect this fee, that is something that I'm not aware of. There doesn't appear to be a funding mechanism per se in the bill, other than to say there would be this non-resident decal for bikes. how that would be sold, where you would buy it. That was not included in the discussion yesterday.
Seems pretty arbitrary and kind of strange. And another senator actually did speak up, asking if the senator who introduced it, Senator Sayles, was serious about the amendment, but it did pass. So now we know, the last thing I read, it had gone through two of the three readings. So it is on the way to the House now.
It is. As of about an hour ago, they did pass it on third reading.
Did anybody bring up, and I know it was probably, again, that last-minute Hail Mary kind of thing, did anybody bring up the whole idea of how important cycling might be to tourism in Montana?
Not presently on the floor yesterday, but after sort of Senator Sayles, and this was a couple weeks ago on this safety bill, after his comments there, I think what happened was you saw a lot of interest all of a sudden in his comments, and probably he felt some blowback from it. I think that's safe to say. And part of that argument was likely that he heard from cyclists or cycling advocates that there is an impact from cycling tourism and different people that come through and spend money in Montana, especially in the summer. We're obviously pretty seasonal here when it comes to biking. And I think he, likely took that to heart, and this was his response to it. Now, whether you agree with it or not, I can't really comment on that, but I think he is likely saying, well, if you're going to tell me that you're these great stewards and you're going to spend all this money here, then let's see you have some skin in the game, which is what he said yesterday.
Interesting. And I can't disagree from that perspective. I guess I just look at it that if a cyclist comes through Montana and ends up spending $300 or $400 or $500 or $600 at a hotel and food and all those other things, that maybe that $25 fee discourages people. You know, you begin to wonder how he might weigh the odds. So how long will it be before this bill actually comes up before the House?
My guess it'll be in committee within the next week or two. We have middle of April is about when this will end. So it'll come up pretty quick and move through. And essentially, it's a revenue bill, which are treated a little differently than legal bills, which would pass laws. When they're dealing with sort of funding mechanisms, the deadline's a little different. And I'm by far from an expert on exactly all the intricacies of how our legislature works. But my understanding would be it would probably be in the next week or two.
And so there is a way, perhaps, that listeners could follow it, and certainly people in Montana. I mean, people seem to be in the letter-writing, card-sending mode right now all over the country. So I guess this would just qualify as another cause but this one's really important to my listeners, I think.
Sure. I mean, we accept letters to the editor. All the papers do. We do tend to give preference to folks that are in-state or
sure.
in our areas just for space-wise, but we'll definitely continue reporting on it. I mean, this is an $11 million program, which Montana has less than 1 million people in it, or just a little over 1 million, I should say, now. We just had our census. But in light of that, funding big projects like that, $11 million is a lot. It's a pretty big ask for folks in our state. So as that Aquatic Invasive Species Bill works through, we'll be following that. And definitely my prediction is I don't think this will be in the final bill as it works through the House. My anticipation is it'll be amended out. But again, it that's a little bit speculative. So
we can take that as a maybe, and I like that. I really appreciate you talking with me today. We will follow the story. Thanks for writing it. And I hope that your bill passes. These invasive species situations are really dangerous. We are fighting similar things here in the Great Lakes. So thanks so much.
All right.
A lot. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Tom Coughlin joined me from Helena, Montana, to talk about this amendment to Senate Bill 363. It did pass. It's on its way to the House. It includes the amendment for a $25 fee for out-of-state cyclists. If you're interested, you can keep following the story. We will continue to report on it. We're going to take a real quick break. We'll be right back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. are back on the Outspoken Cyclist, and as promised, we're going to head on over to Boston and speak with Richard Fries, the director of Mass Bike. Hello, Richard. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist.
Great to be here.
It's time to talk. There's so much going on at Mass Bike. Where should we begin? Go ahead. Start.
Well, I'm flattered you think there is, because I just am lamenting to a colleague here that I feel like I'm playing chess and all I have are pawns. You can just move little bits at a time, but we are doing a lot. And the hard thing about advocacy, Diane, especially statewide advocacy, is that it's not rabble-rousing and loud, and yet it's so really, really important. It's just that it's not a lot of ribbon cuttings, not a lot of groundbreaking, not a lot of sign holding, but steady pressure. But we're doing some great things.
I think you are. There are several that popped up for me. One was a new Tri-County bikeway.
Yep.
What's going on with that?
Well, if you look at a Strava heat map, you'll see this big, bright current of activity along the Minuteman Bikeway. And what's happening is it's almost like when you have a really big tornado, a lot of little tornadoes spin off of it. And, you know, you've got the Tri-County, you've got one, Wakefield and Linfield, which is going to connect to that eventually. We've just been really hitting hard on our five-year improvement plan. And it's just loaded with little 1 and 2 mile extensions of things here. You know, you look at the great folks in Missouri who have that entire cross-state trail, and we don't have that in Mass. So we're pushing on the Mass Central. We're pushing on the Bruce Freeman. These are like two big axes of, if you will, of rail trails that are chugging along. Folks, you know, down in the South Shore between New Bedford and Fall River, they're halfway across a 50-mile path. Sadly, it's never done the way we did in the interstates. It's done in little pieces. There's just a lot of them everywhere.
Yeah, so, but it's nice that they're starting to connect. I mean, we have a lot of little disjointed paths, too. But once they start to connect, you start to be able to go from town to town, urban center to urban center, and you start seeing some real progress with bike transportation.
Well, you've hit it right on the head. The focus of, and we're really excited because of where we are. We share some space with Livable Streets, and Walk Boston is one block over, and other groups like T4MA is right here in the building with us. But we're really starting to collaborate on bigger corridor projects, you know, where there's always something there, but we want it to be perfect, because what we've proven is when you build great things, you can then come off of it. The Minuteman being that major one, but Mass Ave runs right along it. But the connectivity with our subway system, our commuter rail system, it's really pushing our economy into the 21st century. One of the leading indicators of why people want to move to the Boston metro area and Massachusetts is you can live without a car.
Well, you know, we used to look to New York City for all these crazy bike things, these wonderful bike things that happen,
yeah,
partly because of Jeanette Sadiq Khan. But now it looks like Boston is where we need to look to see what's new. For example, opening day, you guys are parking bikes.
Yeah, we do bike valet. The Red Sox and the San Francisco Giants are the only two major league parks that offer you bike parking. And a lot of it is for anybody that has ever been to the jewel of the park that is Fenway, is it's really shoehorned into a living neighborhood. So the Red Sox organization, rightfully so, is doing everything they can to soften their footprint in that neighborhood. We just think it's hilarious that from a cultural standpoint, people choose to drive in and pay $30 to park.
God,
now we get about 30 to 50 bikes every game, but it's only our third year. So we're expecting those numbers to really grow with a little bit more promotion. We're working with Hubway, which is our bike share program. We're working with a great program that others in your show could emulate, which is Park and Pedal. You know, you park, you know, 4 or 5 miles out, ride on a bike path, and you ride in. Great way to go in with your family.
You know, maybe I should talk to the Cleveland Indians. That's a really cool idea. You know, we're right in the middle of downtown, though. So it's,
yeah,
parking's expensive. It's crazy. So I had no idea that Mass Bike was 40 years old, and you are celebrating a 40th birthday in May.
Yeah.
Really?
I'm feeling 39 of them, yeah.
Yeah, as a brand new director, right? Yeah, I was only going to work this part-time, right? It's 24/7, isn't it?
It's really something.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are. We're coming up. We have a little bash. It's going to be May 16th. You know, when you look at it in 1977, when we were founded, there was only 2 miles of bike path in all of Massachusetts. It was on a little bit of the Paul Dudley White. And you look at where we're at now, we're approaching 200 miles of bike path. untold mileage of bike lanes, and with one of the more progressive DOTs, you know, complete streets are not just in Cambridge and Somerville, but it's really just about every one of our 23 gateway cities are implementing this stuff. People that need bikes the most, really, folks that won't listen to your show, folks that don't belong to Mass Bike, folks that don't talk about themselves as a bicyclist at a barbecue. Sitting in Pittsfield, Mass recently, and during the course of a meeting with somebody with their back to a window, I was like, 50 people must have gone by. And they were all on department store bikes and things like that. So we really need to keep working. These complete streets programs really are effective in commercial districts.
Well, I'm hoping more people do listen to the show for these reasons exactly, that everybody should get on a bike. It's not just about the guy in Lycra, you know. I wanted to broaden the conversation a little bit about what you think with the new administration in Washington and the discussion that's been going on about infrastructure, what you're hoping to see at federal, state, local levels to improve cycling as opposed to just build roads and bridges.
Well, I just came back from the National Bike Summit a few weeks ago. From a political standpoint, I think we're seeing the self-immolation of the Trump presidency. Regardless of how you feel about him politically, he played some cards that were not very wise, when I think that had he come out of the gate, and this is being echoed throughout political circles, had he come out of the gate and played the infrastructure card instead of the infrastructure or healthcare card, infrastructure is something that benefits every American. We like what he says in general terms, but when you raise the military budget by $52 billion and you have an elected that won't pass a gas tax, which hasn't been increased since the early 1990s, I don't know what that's going to mean. The issue is Elizabeth Chao, the new transportation secretary, is not very kind to bikes. It doesn't look like bikes are going to be there. But the silver lining for me, not for every one of my brothers and sisters around the country, but the silver lining here is that they're probably going to revert to a sort of a state control program where federal dollars will go to you. You can do what you want with it. In a state like Massachusetts, we're going to jump all over the bike ped stuff and the transit stuff. Other folks that we were seeing make great strides, places like Oklahoma, places like South Carolina, you know, they will revert back to 1965 transportation mentality and make it for highway only.
Yeah, I'm hoping Ohio is not one of those states, but it just depends. Kasich cannot run again. There are term limits in Ohio. So now we're going to have a feisty governor's race. Well, you know, I talked to Keith Laughlin last week, and he sort of intimated that the Tiger grants look like they were on the chopping block. So, yeah, I guess it's going to go back to states, and hopefully some states will wake up and say, you know, it's not all about roads and bridges, but we'll see. But, yeah, Massachusetts, I believe, is probably going to take advantage of it. That would be great for Ohio, too.
Well, I think the key thing here is mayors. Mayors have power. Mayors have discretion. Mayors also have very limited funds. And I think what you're seeing is you can do bike and ped stuff for the equivalent of finding coins in your sofa. It's what it takes to do good bike ped stuff, and it's been proven effective. We now have a lot of good data. We have a lot of good case studies. And I do believe that if you go back to the 2016 election, the battleground really turned out to be Youngstown, Ohio, Altoona, Pennsylvania, Evanston, Illinois, cities like that. And they're blank canvases. The mayors can do a lot with bike and ped stuff. They realize they have to reinvigorate their downtowns, and that's how you do it. You can do it, as I said, you know, for what is effectively coin sound in the sofa relative to big bridges, big infrastructure. But we'll see. Right now, the current federal mindset is all guns and no butter, you know, to go back to Econ 101.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Richard Fries. He is the director of Mass Bike, obviously in Massachusetts. Let me just ask you to rank your three most important projects that are on your drawing board right now for cycling in general. What would they be, and how are you addressing them? In your state, or you can go to Boston.
What's keeping me up at night?
Okay, what's keeping Richard up at night?
Well, number one, our biggest thing is that we filed the largest bike bill in the history of our state house legislature. Everything from a 3-foot passing rule to uniform crash reporting protocol for cops. So it's a really big bill with about 14 major components to it. So we got to get that into hearings. The hearings will start in about 2 months, and we're really preparing for that. It could be groundbreaking. I would say number two in all that for me right now is really getting our, from an advocacy point of view, really ramping up our educational offerings. We are already doing Safe Routes to School, but we also are starting to do a lot of adult education. And that's really important. And that includes the spandex crowd, teaching them, you know, some stuff on riding. And the other thing that we're really pushing on hard here is we're expanding our chapters. We want to have 7 chapters statewide by the time this year is done. We already have most of them signed on and we're starting to work with them, but it's one of those pawns that we're playing with. It's really hard to keep them all going because we really believe that the bike advocacy movement has had great strides and great success in the cities, but we really see the suburbs and rural communities and those smaller cities as really, that's where we really need to see some advocacy. And we're pretty excited about our Berkshire chapter, our Pioneer Valley chapter is doing great things. And we're doing great things in terms of teaching them to be little urban bike advocacy units. I really think that's the ground game that we need in advocacy.
So you have how many chapters now and you're going for 7? What's in place?
I've got 4 right now.
Okay, so you've...
We want to have 7 by the end of the season. And I liken it to, you know, our mantra is here at Mass Bike, we advocate, we educate, we connect. We really want to build strong teams that are out there. I liken it to the movie 101 Dalmatians. There's an early scene where the puppies are stolen and they have the twilight bark, if you remember the cartoon. And we want to teach all of our dogs to bark when it's appropriate to bark. And that's how we bond together. I'm really learning, and I'm really slow to learn, the effectiveness of making noise. You know, nothing in government moves unless it's pushed. And teaching these local folks to really push and how to do it and where to put the leverage from a statewide and local level, and then also making sure that you can still break bread with local officials. You know, you can't be too strident.
Right.
So, I just came away from there's this one MassDOT committee I had this morning, and I sit in there and we go through 25 pages of projects where they're asking to be excused from bicycle accommodations. It's not all of them, but there's various bike ped criteria that they're trying to stay away from. And I'm the guy that I've slowly learned how to write letters. It doesn't seem like it makes a lot, but when I put a letter on letterhead, sign it, date it, and put it in the file, next thing you know, those projects get stalled. You can do great things. I think people are a little bit jaded from the election, but you can do great things at the local level.
Oh, absolutely. I totally believe that. Squeaky wheel, all you have to do is speak up, you know, show up.
Yeah.
Show up to council meetings, you know, show up to town hall meetings, anything that's there. So I want to switch gears a little bit. No pun intended. I always say that.
That's all right.
One of my favorite riders of all time is Tyler Hamilton.
Okay.
And it looks like you're promoting an event with him. Or you're involved somehow with an event that he's going to be doing in your area?
Well, we've gotten some rumblings of it, and we're still waiting to hear from Tyler. Tyler and I go way back. He rode for the same club I rode. When I was finishing up, he was just coming up, and he was a wunderkind. And I basically would ride him to a point in a bike race and say, okay, this is where you go. And then he would go and win the race. And it's really, I have a few funny Tyler Hamilton stories, but he was really a gifted guy, and he's really been an articulate, decent human being. And I think he got swept into a very seductive situation that is very hard to extricate yourself from. I don't think in the sport was very fair to him. But, you know, I think a lot of these guys I think we still need that notoriety back in the world of cycling. And, we could certainly use a guy like Tyler in the world of advocacy to speak up. And we're starting to see more and more racers getting it as we get more and more stories of cyclists being struck and, you know, training rides having these flashpoints around road rage and such things. So,
yeah, there was another one this week. I remember that. So, you know, you alluded to this, and let's just talk about it. Before you became director of Mass Bike, you were doing other things, including announcing races. Are you still announcing races?
Yeah, I'm going to go down to Dallas and do one next weekend. I'm going to do the Sea Otter. I still work weekends as a bike race announcer, less than I used to. I kind of have my steady Eddie clients. As long as I fly JetBlue and I work on a Friday afternoon online, it's okay with my board. And it still keeps me very associated and connected to the sport. Sadly, I believe this is as much as a part of the advocate element as it is the club element and the racing element of it. There's a divide between the two. We are too small of a market to be divided, and we need more racers in advocacy. And so I really pride myself on bringing racers into advocacy. They have a very important job to play.
Well, I think if you do it, you've done something very wonderful for our bicycle world, because it does need it. It needs it very badly. You know, all these little factions need to start coming together for all the same purposes. That's making bicycles and bicycle riding safe and enjoyable and sort of universal in the U.S. like it is elsewhere. So are you following the spring classics?
I have not been able to follow them as I once used to, but I'm kind of getting ready for the big ones in April. Those are the ones that really, you know, I've watched some of the very early ones a little bit, and they've been great. I'm really eager to see how long these people can hold their fitness. I'm really waiting to see how Richie Port, if he can hold on with how good he's been doing. But, you know, I also think we're seeing the last of, watching such riders as, you know, when you look at Tom Boonen, I love to watch Lars Boom. I love to watch the one-day guys. And, you know, we're seeing some of them go into their twilight. So one more great ride with Tom Boonen, you know, Paris-Roubaix, and we'll see what happens. But I'll never forget watching him when he was 21 race in America. So
wow, that was a long time ago.
It makes me, that was a long time ago. Watching these people retire is really something. But I also, it's kind of interesting because it's there's so much pressure on the stage races. I'm still a one-day guy. So really a big fan of GVA and Greg Van Avermaet, and want to see how he does.
Yeah, he's slated to do well this year, and he did well last year. Last topic, Ballers. Ha-ha, it's coming to Boston.
Oh, right.
Right. Are you excited?
Well, you know, it's like the problem with me is that I'm a short-order cook. You know, I have all these tickets right
It's what's in front of you, right?
Yeah, and you're like,
September's really far away. It's September, September 22nd, because you might be interested to know, I was just asked to be a member of the East Coast Greenway Advisory Board.
I know.
Of course you know. How would you not know that?
And, well, what a great organization they are. And that's really interesting. You know, when you look at Eric Weiss and the Builder's Ball coming, that's 1 week before the KMC Crossfest, which I also do.
Right.
Which means we can probably get you to stay out here a week.
we'll see about that.
I'm also just so excited about little things that we've pulled together at the Thompson Speedway for the KMC Crossfest. On Thursday, it's a dealer-only day, but we're having a Corvette Club come in.
And no
way. Charity hour on the Speedway at about 150 miles an hour in Corvettes to raise funds for the East Coast Greenway Lions, which seems like strange bedfellows, but they've been very game. It's a Corvette Club that's going to help us raise some funds. We're hoping to do a luncheon for them. So that's going to be a really important thing. East Coast Greenway moving on so many fronts right now.
Right. And I would love to ride. Brian and I have been talking about riding a piece of it this coming year, but I definitely am coming to Boston for the Builder's Ball. I am going to be at whatever East Coast Greenway functions I need to be at, you know,
yeah,
wherever I'm invited, I'm going to come. I'm so excited about being included in the organization. It makes me really happy.
Well, we'll name you the Bell of the Ball.
Oh, the Bell of the Ball. Isn't that sweet? All right. I know you need to go back to doing 10,000 mass bike things. I really appreciate you talking with me today. Have a wonderful, wonderful 40th anniversary, and we'll talk again.
All right. Thanks a lot, Terry.
All right.
Great job.
Thanks.
Stay safe.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Richard Fries joined me from the offices at Mass Bike in Boston. Always an interesting conversation. I'd like to thank him and my guest, Dave Kirk, for the time and great conversations. I enjoyed them both. In the few moments we have before ending this episode of the show, I must take a moment to remember a friend and colleague who passed away this week. I spoke with Mike Demme just a few short weeks ago about all the great things that are happening at Adventure Cycling Association. He was a 24-year veteran of the organization and a vital part of the face of it. Mike died suddenly and unexpectedly of apparently natural causes on Tuesday. He was only 51. Here is the official announcement released by Adventure Cycling on Thursday. "This is a tremendous loss for the organization, operationally and personally," said Jim Sayre, Adventure Cycling's executive director. "It is no overstatement to say that Mike was one of the most important staff people in Adventure Cycling's history, in the way that he transformed the magazine into one of the most beloved cycling magazines anywhere. He also played a crucial role in diversifying our communication offerings and developing our design and media department. We are still trying to absorb what life without Mike Demme will be like. Mike served as assistant editor, editor-in-chief, and executive editor of the publication beginning in 1998 and guided adventure cyclist growth as a voice for bicycle travel and two-wheeled adventure around the world. In 2015, he moved into the executive editor position as he took on a greater organizational role as the director of design and media for Adventure Cycling. Mike's unexpected passing leaves a void in the organization where he began in the mailroom and quickly found his way into publications, where in addition to the magazine, he contributed to and oversaw countless promotional materials, catalogs, and the pre-Google clearinghouse for bicycle travel information, the Cyclist Yellow Pages. The passion he brought to his work throughout his career is irreplaceable, and his mark on adventure cycling, bicycle travel, and cycling in general is profound. Raised in Connecticut, Mike's other passion was chasing a little white ball around a golf course and watching the New York Giants, along with his side job of nearly 30 years as one of Missoula, Montana's best-known bartenders. So I hope everyone remembers that every day and everyone in your life is special. Please take a moment to send your goodwill to Mike and his family. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. In the meantime, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.